sip of the drink was much easier than feigning interest in the Doña.
"Incomparable!"
He coughed, and then, with quick, jerky motions, he loosened his black neckcloths just the slightest bit. The Salvaras smirked charmingly together.
"I'm reminded again why I have such success selling gentler liquors to you people."
2. Once per month, there was no trading done in the shifting market. Every fourth idler's day, the merchants stayed clear of the great sheltered circle abutting the Angevin River. Instead, they drifted or anchored nearby, while half the city came out to see the shifting revel. Camorre had never possessed a great stone or elderglass amphitheatre, and had fallen instead into the curious custom of rebuilding its spectator circle anew at each revel. Huge, multi-storied observation barges were towed out and anchored firmly against the stone breakwaters surrounding the shifting market, like floating slices cut from the heart of great stadiums. Each barge was operated by a rival family or merchant combine and decked in unique livery. They competed fiercely with one another to fill their seats, and inter-vessel brawls between the habitual customers of particularly beloved barges were not unknown. When properly aligned, these barges formed an arc about halfway around the circumference of the shifting market. A channel was left clear for boats entering and leaving the center of the calm water, and the rest of the periphery was reserved for the pleasure barges of the nobility. A good 100 or so could be counted on at any revel, and half again as many for major festivals such as this one. Less than 3 weeks remained until the midsummer mark and the Day of Changes. Even before the entertainments began, the shifting revel was its own spectacle, a great tide of rich and poor, floating and on foot, jostling for position in a traditional contest much loved for its lack of rules. The yellow jackets were always out in force, but more to prevent hard words and fisticuffs from escalating than to prevent disturbances altogether. The revel was a city-wide debauch, a rowdy public service the Duke was happy to underwrite from his treasury. There were few things like a good revel to pull the fangs from any unrest before it had time to fester. Feeling the fire of the approaching noon, despite the silk awning over their heads, Locke and his hosts compounded their situation by drinking ginger scalds as they stared out across the rippling heat haze at thousands of Camorri packing the commoner barges. Conte had prepared identical drinks for his lord and lady, though with a touch less ginger oil, perhaps, which Graumann had served them, as Camorri etiquette dictated in these situations. Locke's glass was half empty. The liquor was a ball of expanding warmth in his stomach and a vivid memory in his throat.
"Business," he said at last. "You have both been so kind to Grau and myself. I agreed to repay this kindness by revealing my business here in Camorre, so let us speak of it, if that would please you."
"You have never had a more eager audience in your life, Master Fairwhite."
The Don's hired rowers were bringing them into the shifting revel proper, and closing on dozens of more traditional pleasure barges, some of them crammed with dozens or hundreds of guests. The Don's eyes were alive with greedy curiosity.
"Tell on."
"The Kingdom of the Seven Marrows is coming apart at the seams."
Locke sighed.
"This is no secret."
The Don and the Doña nonchalantly sipped their drinks, saying nothing.
"The canton of Emberlane is peripheral to the major conflict, but the Graf von Emberlane and the Black Table are both working, in different directions, to place it in the way of substantial harm."
"The Black Table?" asked the Don.
"I beg pardon."
Locke took the tiniest sip of his drink and let new fire trickle under his tongue.
"The Black Table is what we call the Council of Emberlane's most powerful merchants. My masters of the House of Bel-Oster are among them. In every respect save the military and the matter of taxes, they run the canton of Emberlane. And they are tired of the Graf, and tired of the trade guilds in the other six cantons of the Marrows, tired of limitations. Emberlane grows rich on new means of speculation and enterprise. The Black Table sees the old guilds as a weight around their neck.
Curious, said the Doña, that you say their and not our. Is this significant?
To a point. Another sip of the drink, a second of feigned nervousness. The House of Bel Oster agrees that the guilds have outlasted their usefulness, that the trade practices of centuries past should not be set in stone by guild law. We do not necessarily agree. He sipped the drink yet again and scratched the back of his head. That the Graf von Emberlein should be deposed while he is out of the canton with most of his army, showing his flag on behalf of his cousins in Parley and Somne.
Holy 12!
Don Salvara shook his head, as though to clear it of what he'd just heard.
They can't be serious. Your state is smaller than the Duchy of Camor, exposed to the sea on two sides. Impossible to defend.
And yet the preparations are underway. Emberlane's banks and merchant houses do 4 times the yearly business of the next richest canton in the Marrows. The Black Table fixates upon this. Gold should certainly be considered potential power. The Black Table errs by imagining it to be direct power in and of itself. He finished his drink in one long, deliberate draught. In 2 months, civil war will have broken out anyway. The succession is a mess. The Stradas and the Dvorims, the Razuls and the Strigs, they are all sharpening knives and parading men. Yet, as we speak, the merchants of Emberlane are moving to arrest the remaining nobility while the Graf is away, to claim the navy, to raise a levy of free citizens, to hire mercenaries. In short, they will now attempt to secede from the Marrows. It is unavoidable.
And what specifically does this have to do with you coming here?
The Doña's knuckles were white around her wine flute. She grasped the full significance of Fairwhite's story. A fight larger than anything seen in centuries. Civil war mixed with possible economic disaster. It is the opinion of my masters, the House of Bel Oster, that rats in the hold have little chance to take the wheel of a ship that is about to run aground. But those same rats may very easily abandon the ship.
3. In the center of the shifting revel, a great many tall iron cages had been sunk into the water. Some of these served to support wooden slats on which performers, victims, fighters, and attendants could stand. A few particularly heavy cages restrained dark shapes that circled ominously under the translucent grey water. Platform boats were rowed around at a steady clip, showing off rope dancers, knife throwers, acrobats, jugglers, strongmen, and other curiosities. The excited shouts of barkers with long brass speaking trumpets echoed flatly off the water. First up at any revel were the penance bouts, where petty offenders from the Palace of Patience could volunteer for mismatch combat in exchange for reduced sentences or slightly improved living conditions. At present, a hugely muscled Nicovezzo, punishing hand, one of the Duke's own household guard, was handing out the beatings. The soldier was armoured in black leather, with a gleaming steel breastplate and a steel helmet crested with the freshly severed fin of a giant flying fish. Scales and spines scintillated as the soldier stepped back and forth under the bright sun, striking out seemingly at leisure with an iron-shod staff. The Nicovezzo stood on a platform that was small but rock-steady. A series of circular wooden flats surrounded him, separated by an arm's-length span of water. These wobbly, unstable platforms were occupied by about 2 dozen slender, grimy prisoners, each armed with a small wooden cudgel. A concerted rush might have overwhelmed their armored tormentor, but this lot seemed to lack the temperament for cooperation. Approaching the Nicovezzo singly or in little groups, they were being dropped one after another with skull-rattling blows. Little boats circled to fish out unconscious prisoners before they slipped under the water forever. The Duke, in his mercy, did not allow penance bouts to be deliberately lethal. Locke held his empty wine flute out for just a second. Conte plucked it out of his fingers with the grace of a swordsman disarming an opponent. When the Don's manservant stepped toward the liquor cabinet, Locke cleared his throat.
No need to refill that particular glass just yet, Conte. Too kind, too kind. But with your permission, my lord and Lady Salvara, I should like to offer a pair of gifts. One as a matter of simple hospitality, the other as a... well, you'll see. Grauman?
Locke snapped his fingers, and Jean nodded. The heavy-set man moved over to a wooden table just beside the liquor cabinet and picked up two heavy leather satchels, each of which had iron-reinforced corners and small iron locks sewn into their covers. Jean set these down where the Salvaras could easily see them, and then stepped back so Locke could unseal the satchels with a delicate key of carved ivory. From the first satchel he withdrew a cask of pale aromatic wood, perhaps 1 foot in height and half that in diameter, which he then held out for Don Salvara's examination. A plain black brand on the surface of the cask read,
Brandvin Osterschalin 502.
Don Lorenzo's breath hissed in between his teeth. Perhaps his nostrils even flared, though Locke kept the face of Lucas Fairwhite politely neutral.
12 gods, a 502! Lucas, if I seem to be teasing you for your refusal to part with your goods, please accept my deepest...
You needn't apologize, my lord.
Locke held up a hand and mimicked the Don's gesture for shooing words down out of the air.
For your bold intervention on my behalf, Don Salvara, and for your excellent hospitality this morning, fair Doña, please accept this minor ornament for your cellars.
Minor?
The Don took the cask and cradled it as though it were an infant not 5 minutes born.
I have a 506 and a pair of 504s. I don't know of anyone in Camor that has a 502, except probably the Duke.
Well, said Locke, my masters have kept a few on hand ever since the word got out that it was a particularly good blend. We use them to break the ice in matters of grave business importance.
In truth, that cask represented an investment of nearly 800 full crowns and a sea trip up the coast to Ashmere, where Locke and Jean had contrived to win it from an eccentric minor noble in a rigged card game. Most of the money had actually gone to evade or buy off the assassins the old man had later sent after his property. The 502 vintage had become almost too precious to drink.
What a grand gesture, Master Fairwhite.
Doña Sofia slipped a hand through the crook of her husband's elbow and gave him a possessive grin.
Lorenzo, love, you should try to rescue strangers from Emberlane more often. They're so charming.
Locke coughed and shuffled his feet.
Hardly, my lady. Now, Don Salvara,
please do call me Lorenzo.
Don Lorenzo. What I have to show you next relates rather directly to my reason for coming here.
From the second satchel he drew out a similar cask, but this one was marked only with a stylized A within a circle of vines.
This, said Locke, is a sample drawn from last year's distillation, the 559.
Don Salvara dropped the cask of 502. The Doña, with girlish agility, shot out her right foot to hook the cask in mid-air and let it down to the deck with a slight thump rather than a splintering crash. Unbalanced, she did manage to drop her ginger scald. The glass vanished over the side and was soon 20 feet under water. The Salvaras steadied one another, and the Don picked his cask of 502 back up, his hands shaking.
Lucas, he said, surely... surely you must be kidding.
4. Locke didn't find it particularly easy to eat lunch while watching a dozen swimming men being pulled apart by a Gerishti devilfish, but he decided that his master merchant of Emberlane had probably seen worse in his many imaginary sea voyages, and he kept his true feelings far from his face. Noon was well past, the penance bouts were over, and the revel masters had moved on to the judicial forfeitures. This was a polite way of saying that the men in the water were murderers, rapists, slavers, and arsonists, selected to be colourfully executed for the amusement of the revel crowds. Technically speaking, they were armed and would receive lesser sentences if they could somehow contrive to slay whatever beast they were matched against. But the beasts were always as nasty as their weapons were laughable, so mostly they were just executed. The devilfish's tentacles were 12 feet long, the same length as its undulating grey and black striped body. The creature was confined within a 60-foot circle of cages and platforms, along with a number of screaming, flailing, water-treading men, most of whom had long since dropped their slender little daggers into the water. Nervous guards, armed with crossbows and pikes, patrolled the platform, shoving prisoners back into the water if they tried to scramble out. Occasionally, the devilfish would roll over in the churning red waters, and Locke would catch a glimpse of one lidless black eye the size of a soup bowl, not unlike the bowl currently held in his hands.
"More, Master Fairwhite?"
Conte hovered nearby with the silver tureen of chilled soup cradled in his hands. White-fleshed iron sea prawns floated in a heavy red tomato base seasoned with peppers and onions. Don and Doña Salvara were a peculiar sort of droll.
"No, Conte, most kind, but I'm well satisfied for the time being."
Locke set his soup bowl down beside the broached cask of 559, actually a bottle of lowly 50-crown 550 liberally mixed with the roughest overpriced rum Jean had been able to get his hands on, and took a sip of the amber liquor from his snifter. Even mixed with crap, the counterfeit was delicious. Grauman stood attentively behind Locke's hosts, who were seated opposite Locke at the intimate little table of oiled silverwood. Doña Sofia toyed unself-consciously with a subtlety of gelled orange slices, paper-thin and arranged in whorls to form edible tulip blossoms. Don Lorenzo stared down at the snifter of brandy in his hands, his eyes still wide.
"It seems almost sacrilegious."
Despite this sentiment, the Don took a deep gulp of the stuff, satisfaction well evident in the lines of his face. In the distance behind him, something that might have been a severed torso flew up into the air and came back down with a splash. The crowd roared approval. Osterschalin brandy was famously aged for a minimum of 7 years after distillation and blending. It was impossible for outsiders to get their hands on a cask any sooner than that. The house of Bell Oster's factors were forbidden even to speak of the batches that were not yet on sale. The location of the vintners' aging houses was a secret that was reportedly guarded by assassination when necessary. Don Lorenzo had been struck stupid when Locke had casually offered up a cask of 559. He had nearly thrown up when Locke had just as casually opened the seal and suggested they share it with lunch.
"It is," Locke chuckled. "The brandy is the religion of my house. So many rules, so many rituals, so many penalties."
No longer smiling, he drew a quick finger across his throat.
"It's possible we're the only people in history to have an unaged sample with a lunch of soup. I thought you might enjoy it."
"I am."
The Don swirled the liquor in his glass and stared at it, as though hypnotized by the soft caramel-colored translucence.
"And I'm dead serious about what sort of scheme you've got up your sleeve, Lucas."
"Well,"
Locke swirled his own drink theatrically.
"There have been 3 invasions of Emberlane in the past 250 years. Let's be frank. The succession rights of the Kingdom of the Marrows always involves armies and blood before they involve blessings and banquets. When the Graffs quarrel, the Ostershalin Mountains are only landward barrier and the site of heavy fighting. This fighting inevitably spills down the eastern slopes of the mountains, right through the vineyards of the House of Bel-Oster. How could it be different this time? Thousands of men and horses coming over the passes, trampling the vineyards, sacking everything in sight. It might even be worse now that we have fire oil. Our vineyards could be ashes half a year from now. You can't exactly pack your vineyards up and take them with you if you jump ship, said Don Lorenzo. No, Locke sighed. It's the Ostershalin soils, in part, that make Ostershalin brandy. If we lose those vineyards, it will be just as it was before, an interruption of growth and distillation. 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, or more. And it gets worse. Our position is terrible. The Graf can't let Emberlane's ports and revenue go if the Marrows are coming to civil war. He and his allies will storm the place as fast as possible. They'll likely put the Black Table to the sword, impound their goods and properties, nationalize their funds. The House of Bel-Oster won't be spared. At the moment, the Black Table is acting quietly but firmly. Grau and I sailed 5 days ago, just 12 hours before we knew the port would be sealed off. No Emberlane-flagged ships are being allowed out. They're all being docked and secured for repairs or quarantine. Nobles still loyal to the Graf are under house arrest by now, their guards disarmed. Our funds in various lending houses of Emberlane have been temporarily frozen. All the Black Table merchant houses have consented to do this to one another. It makes it impossible for any house to flee en masse with its gold and its goods. Currently, Grau and I are operating on our local credit line, established at Maraggio's years ago. My house, well, we simply didn't keep our funds outside Emberlane, just a bit here and there for emergencies. Locke watched the Salvaras very closely for their reaction. His news from Emberlane was as fresh and specific as possible, but the Don might have sources of intelligence the gentleman bastards hadn't spotted in their weeks of surveillance and preparation. The parts about the Black Table and the impending civil war were solid, educated speculation. The part about a sudden port closure and house arrests was pure homespun bullshit. In Locke's estimation, the real mess in Emberlane wouldn't start for a few months. If the Don was wise to this, the game might be blown. Conte might be trying to pin Locke to the table with his daggers in just a few seconds. And then Jean would pull out the hatchets he had concealed down the back of his vest, and everyone in the little group beneath the silk awning would get very, very uncomfortable. But the Salvaras said nothing. They merely continued to stare at him with eyes that plainly invited him to go on. Emboldened, he continued. "This situation is unbearable. We will neither be hostages to a cause that we barely profess, nor victims for the Graf's vengeance upon his inevitable return. We choose a somewhat risky alternative, one that would require substantial aid from a noble of Camor. You, Don Salvara, if it is within your means." The Don and his wife had clasped hands under the table. He waved his hand at Locke excitedly. "We can surrender our funds. By taking no steps to secure them, we buy ourselves more time to act. And we are quite confident that replacing those funds will merely be a matter of time and effort. We can even abandon..." Locke gritted his teeth. "We can even abandon our vineyards. We will completely burn them ourselves, leaving nothing to anyone else. After all, we enhance the soil ourselves, alchemically. And the secret of that enhancement is kept only in the hearts of our planting masters."
"The Ostershalin process," Sophia breathed, betrayed by her own rising excitement.
"Of course, you've heard of it. Well, there are only 3 planting masters at any given time, and the process is complex enough to defy soil examination, even by someone with talents such as yours, my lady. Many of the compounds our alchemists use are inert, and intended only to confuse the matter. So that's that. The one thing we cannot abandon is our stock of aging blends. The last 6 years, batched in their casks, and certain rare vintages and special experiments. We store the Osterschalin in 32-gallon casks. There are nearly 6,000 such casks in our possession. We have to get them out of Emberlane. We have to do it in the next few weeks, before the Black Table imposes harsher control measures, and before the Graf begins laying siege to his canton. And now our ships are under guard, and all of our funds are untouchable.
You want to get all of these casks out of Emberlane? All of them?
The Don actually gulped. As many as possible, said Locke.
And for this you would involve us how?
Doña Sophia was fidgeting. Emberlane flagged ships can no longer leave port, nor enter if they wish to escape again, but a small flotilla of Camorre-flagged ships with Camorre crews financed by a Camorre noble. Locke set his glass of brandy down and spread both his hands in the air.
You wish me to provide a naval expedition?
2 or 3 of your larger galleons should do it. We're looking at 1,000 tons of cargo, casks and brandy alike. Minimal crew, say 50 or 60 men a ship. We can take our pick of the docks and get sober, trustworthy captains. 6 or 7 days beating north, plus however long it takes to scratch the crews and ships together. I guess less than a week. Do you concur?
A week, yes, but you're asking me to finance all of this?
In exchange for a most handsome recompense, I assure you.
Provided everything goes well, yes, and we'll come to the matter of recompense in a moment, but just the rapid acquisition of 2 galleons, good captains, and very reliable crews.
Plus, said Locke, something to stick in the hold for the trip north. Cheap grain, dried cheese, low-grade fresh fruit, nothing special. But Emberlane will shortly be under siege. The Black Table will be happy to have a cache of extra supplies offloaded. Emberlane's position is too tenuous to fail to respect the sovereign neutrality of Camorre. That's what my masters are counting on to get the ships in and out. But added assurance cannot hurt.
Yes, said Don Lorenzo, tugging on his lower lip. 2 galleons, crews, officers, cheap cargo. A small crew of mercenaries, 10 or 12 a ship. There are always some hanging around the Viscount's gate this time of year. I'd want a hard corps of armed men on each ship to discourage complications.
Locke nodded.
So how exactly would we go about removing the casks from your aging houses and transporting them to the docks?
A very simple ruse, said Locke. We maintain several breweries and storehouses for small beer. It's a sideline, a sort of hobby for some of our blending masters. Our beer is stored in casks, and the location of these warehouses is public knowledge. Slowly, carefully, while Grau and I sailed south, my masters have been moving casks of Osterschalin brandy to the beer warehouses and relabeling them. They will continue to do so while we prepare here, and until our ships appear in the harbor of Emberlane.
So you won't be loading brandy in secret?
Doña Sophia clapped her hands together.
As far as anyone knows, you'll be loading beer in the open.
Exactly, my lady. Even the large export of beer won't be anywhere near as suspicious as a movement of the unaged brandy. It'll be looked on as a commercial coup. We'll be the first to dodge the interdict on Emberlane-flagged vessels. We'll bring in a pile of supplies for the coming siege, and a fine apparent profit for ourselves. Then, once we've got all the brandy loaded, we'll put out to sea, bringing 60 or 70 Bell Oster family and employees to form the nucleus of our new business operations in Camorre. Discovery after that will be immaterial.
All of this to be thrown together on short notice.
Don Lorenzo was deep in thought.
15,000 crowns, I'd say. Perhaps 20.
I concur, my lord. Count on an additional 5,000 or so for bribes and other arrangements.
Locke shrugged.
Certain men are going to have to look the other way for us to do our job when we reach Ember Lane, warehouse ruse or no.
25,000 crowns, then. Damn. Lorenzo downed the last of the brandy in his glass, set it down, and folded his hands together on the table before him.
You're asking me for more than half of my fortune.
I like you, Lucas, but now it's time to discuss the other side of the proposal.
Of course.
Lucas stopped to offer the Don another dash of the counterfeit, unaged. The Don began to wave him off, but his taste buds prevailed over his better judgment, and he held out his glass. Doña Sofia did so as well, and Jean hurried over to pass her glass between her and Locke. When he'd served the Salvaras, Locke poured a companionably large amount into his own snifter.
First, you have to understand what the House of Bel Oster is and is not offering. You will never have the Osterschalen process. It will continue to be passed down verbally and strictly within the house. We can afford you no properties as collateral or in payment. We expect to forfeit them upon fleeing Emberlane. Resecuring the vineyards at a future date is our own problem. Any effort on your part to pry into the Osterschalen process to suborn any Bel Oster men or women will be regarded as an absolute breach of trust.
Locke sipped brandy.
I have no idea what specific penalties we could levy to express our displeasure, but it would be fully expressed. I am instructed to be entirely clear on this point.
And so you are.
Doña Sofia placed one hand on her husband's left shoulder.
But these limitations are not yet an offer.
Forgive me, gracious Doña Sofia, for speaking to you like this, but you must understand, this is the most important thing the House of Bel Oster has ever contemplated. Grau and I hold the future of our combine in our rather vulnerable hands. At this moment, I can't speak to you just as your luncheon guest, Lucas Fairwhite. I am the House of Bel Oster. You have to understand that some things are not on the table, not even by the most remote implication.
The Salvaras nodded as one, Sophia just a bit more slowly than Lorenzo.
Now, consider the situation. War is coming to Emberlane. Our vineyards and our properties are as good as lost. And without those vineyards, there will be no Osterschalen actually produced for only the Marrows know how long. 10 years? A generation? Even when we have the vineyards back, the soil will need years to recover. This is the way it has been 3 times before. For many, many years to come, the only new Osterschalen available is going to come from whatever portion of those 6,000 casks we can move out of Emberlane, like thieves in the night. Imagine the demand. The price escalation.
The Don's lips moved unconsciously as he calculated. Doña Sofia stared off into the distance, her brow furrowed. Osterschalen brandy was the finest and most sought-after liquor known. Even the alchemical wines of Tal Vahrar, in 100 bewitching varieties, were not as expensive. A single half-gallon bottle of the youngest available Osterschalen was 30 full crowns at retail. The price went up sharply with age. With a surprise shortage, a fixed supply, and no new crop of Osterschalen grapes in sight?
Fuck them!
Said Conte, totally unable to help himself when the sums involved vanished over his mental horizon.
Beg pardon, Doña Sofia.
You should.
She drained her snifter in one quick unladylike gulp.
Your calculations are off. This merits a triple fuck-damn at least.
The House of Bel Oster, Locke continued,
wishes to establish a partnership with you, based in Camor, to store and market Osterschalen brandy during our interregnum. In exchange for your assistance in transporting it from Emberlane in our moment of extreme need, we are prepared to offer you 50% of the proceeds from the sale of anything you transport for us. Again, consider the situation and the price of Osterschalen during a shortage. You could recoup your initial investment 10 times over in the first year. Give us 5 years, or 10.
Yes, Don Lorenzo fiddled with his optics. But Lucas, somehow, sitting here discussing the possible destruction of your house and the move to a city 500,000 miles to the south, you don't sound entirely displeased.
Locke used a particularly endearing wry smile he'd once practiced before a mirror glass for weeks. When my masters grasped the essence of their current situation, some of them suggested we should have engineered an artificial shortage years ago. As it is, we are determined that we can turn a painful setback into a glorious return. Those 6,000 casks, sold at shortage prices over a number of years, we could return to Emberlane with a fortune that eclipses everything we'd be leaving behind. And as for your own situation,
we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of crowns.
Doña Sofia returned from her thoughtful trance.
We're talking about millions, even split between us.
It would be foolish to presume too much, but yes, there is the possibility that the sums involved could reach such figures. My masters are also prepared to grant one final compensation upon our successful return to Emberlane and the restoration of the Osterschalen vineyards. We offer your family a permanent stake in all Bel Oster operations thereafter. Certainly nothing close to a controlling interest, but something respectable, a 10 to 15% share. You would be the first and, we hope, the only foreigners ever offered such an interest.
There was a brief pause. That's a very attractive offer, Don Salvara said at last. And to think all this was going to fall into Jacobo's lap simply by default. By the gods, Lucas, if we ever cross paths with those thieves again, I'm going to thank them for arranging our introduction.
Well, Locke chuckled, I, for my part, can let bygones be bygones. Grauman might feel somewhat differently. And the fact remains that while I sense we may be shaking hands very soon, we still have to assemble our ships, sail north to Emberlane, and snatch up our prize. The situation is like a damaged cargo rope, unravelling down to a single thread.
He saluted the Salvaras with his brandy snifter.
It will snap!
Out on the water, the devilfish was victorious, and the guards rewarded it for its service by filling it with poisoned crossbow bolts. Boat hooks and chains were used to haul the carcass out of the center of the shifting revel. There was just no putting a creature like that back into the box once it had served its purpose. The monster's red blood mixed with that of its victims and slowly settled in a broad, dark cloud. Even this had a deliberate part to play in what was to come next. 5. Scholars of the Therin Collegium, from their comfortable position well inland, could tell you that the wolf sharks of the Iron Sea are beautiful and fascinating creatures, their bodies more packed with muscle than any bull, their abrasive hide streaked with every colour from old copper green to storm cloud black. Anyone actually working the waterfront in Camor and on the nearby coast could tell you that wolf sharks are big, aggressive bastards that like to jump. Carefully caged, starved, and maddened by blood, wolf sharks are the key to the customary highlight of the shifting revel. Other cities have gladiatorial games, other cities pit men against animals, but only in Camor can you see a specially armed gladiator, a contrarrechiala, battle a live, leaping shark, and in Camor only women are allowed by tradition to be contra reciala. This is the teeth show. 6. Locke couldn't tell if the four women were truly beautiful, but they were undeniably striking. They were all dark-skinned Camori with muscles like farm girls, imposing even at a distance, and they wore next to nothing, tight black cotton shifts across their chests, wrestlers' loincloths, and thin leather gloves. Their black hair was pulled back under the traditional red bandanas and threaded with brass and silver bangles that caught the sunlight in chains of white flashes. The purpose of these bangles was a matter of argument. Some claimed that they confused the poor eyesight of the sharks, while just as many claimed that their glare helped the monsters better sight their prey. Each contra reciala carried two weapons, a short javelin in one hand and a special axe in the other. These axes had grips enclosed by full hand guards, making them difficult to lose. They were double-headed, with the expected curved blade on one side and a long, sturdy pick head on the other. A skilled fighter usually tried to slash a shark's fins and tail to nothing before making a kill. Few but the very best could kill with anything but the spike. Wolf shark skin could be like tree bark. Locke stared at the grim women and felt his usual melancholy admiration. They were, to his eyes, as mad as they were courageous.
"I know that's Cecilia de Ricura there on the far left."
Don Lorenzo was pointing the women out for Lucas Fairwright's benefit, taking a break from more than an hour of rapid negotiations.
"She's decent, and beside her is Agnessa, who carries her javelin but never ever uses it. The other two, well, they must be new, at least new to the revel."
"It's so unfortunate," said the Doña, "that the Barangius sisters aren't out there today, Master Fairwhite. They're the best."
"Probably the best there ever has been."
Don Salvara squinted to cut some of the glare rising off the water, and tried to estimate the size of the sharks, barely visible as shadows within their cages.
"Or ever will be. But they haven't been at the revel for the past few months."
Locke nodded and chewed on the inside of one of his cheeks. As Locke Lamora, garista of the Gentleman Bastards, and respectable sneak thief, he knew the Barangius twins personally. He also knew exactly where they'd been for those past few months. Out on the water, the first fighter was taking her position. Contra Reciala fought across a series of stepping-stone platforms, each about 2 feet wide and raised half a foot off the water. These platforms were set out in a square grid, 4 or 5 feet apart, leaving plenty of room for the opposition to swim between them. The women would have to hop between these platforms at a rapid pace to strike out at the sharks, while dodging leaps in return. A slip into the water was usually the end of the contest. Beyond the line of shark cages, opened by chain pulleys connected to a barge well beyond the periphery of any possible shark activity, there was a little boat, crewed by extremely well-paid volunteer rowers, and carrying the three traditional observers of any teeth show. First, there was a priest of Yono, in his sea-green robes fringed with silver. Beside him, there was a black-robed, silver-masked priestess of Azaguia, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death. Lastly, there was a physica, whose presence had always struck Locke as an extremely optimistic gesture.
"Camor!"
The young woman, apparently Cecilia de Ricura, raised her weapons into the air over her head. The heavy murmur of the crowd subsided, leaving only the noise of water lapping against boats and breakwaters. 15,000 watchers held their collective breath.
"I dedicate this death to Duke Nicovante, our lord and patron!"
Such was the traditional phrasing of the Contra Reciala's salute. This death could conveniently refer to either participant in the battle. With a great flourish of trumpets and the cheer of the crowd, the boatmen outside the circle of cages loosed the afternoon's first shark. The 10-foot fish, already blood-mad, shot forth from imprisonment and began to circle the stepping platforms, its ominous grey fins slicing a ripple line in the water. Cecilia balanced on one foot and bent down to slap the water with the heel of the other, screaming oaths and challenges. The shark took the bait. In a few seconds, it was in amongst the platforms, stocky body whipping back and forth like a toothy pendulum.
"This one doesn't like to waste time!" Don Salvara actually wrung his hands together. "I bet it's an early leaper!"
Barely had these words escaped his mouth than the shark rocketed up out of the water in a fountain of silver spray, hurling itself at the crouching fighter. The shark's leap was not a high one. Cecilia avoided it by jumping right to the next platform over. In midair, she let her javelin go with a backhanded cast. The shaft sunk into the shark's flank and quivered there for a split second before the streamlined mass of hungry muscles splashed back down into the water. Crowd reaction was mixed. The cast had displayed remarkable agility but minimal power. Cecilia's shark was likely only further angered and her javelin wasted.
"Oh, poor decision," the Donya clicked her tongue. "This girl needs to learn some patience. We'll see if her new friend gives her the chance."
Thrashing, spraying pink-foamed water, the shark maneuvered for another attack, chasing Cecilia's shadow on the water. She hopped from platform to platform, axe reversed so the spike was facing outward.
"Master Fairwhite."
Don Lorenzo removed his optics and played with them while he watched the fight. Apparently, they weren't necessary for use at long distances.
"I can accept your terms, but you have to appreciate that my portion of the initial risk is quite heavy, especially relative to my total available funds. My request, therefore, is that the split of revenues from our Osterschalin sales be adjusted to 55-45. In my favor."
Locke pretended to ponder while Cecilia pumped her arms and leapt for dear life, the eager grey fin slashing through the water just behind her feet.
"I'm authorized to make such a concession on behalf of my masters. In return, I would fix your family's ownership interest in the resecured Osterschalin vineyards at 5%.
"Done!" The Don smiled.
"I will fund 2 large galleons, crew and officers, necessary bribes and arrangements, and a cargo to take north with us. I'll oversee 1 galleon, you the other. Mercenary crews of my choosing to be placed aboard each vessel for added security. Conte will travel with you. Your Graumann can stay at my side. Any expenditures that bring our budget over 25,000 Komori crowns are to be made solely at my discretion."
The shark leapt and missed again. Cecilia performed a brief one-armed handstand on her platform, waving her axe. The audience roared while the shark rolled over gracelessly in the water and came back for another pass.
"Agreed," said Locke. "Signed identical copies of our contract to be kept by each of us. 1 additional copy in Therin to be kept with a mutually agreeable neutral solicitor, to be opened and examined by them within the month should one of us have an accident while fetching the casks. 1 additional copy in Vadran to be signed and placed into the care of an agent known to me for eventual delivery to my masters. I shall require a bonded scribe at the Tumble home this evening, and a promissory note for 5,000 crowns to be drawn at Maraggio's tomorrow so I can get to work immediately."
"And that is all that remains?"
"Quite everything," said Locke.
The Don was silent for several seconds.
"The hell with it. I agree. Let's clasp hands and take our chances."
Out on the water, Cecilia paused and hefted her axe, timing a blow as the shark approached her platform on her right, undulating, moving too slow for a high leap. Just as Cecilia shifted her weight to bring the spike down, the shark jackknifed in the water beside her, squeezing its body into a U-shape, and drove itself straight downward. This maneuver flicked its tail into the air, catching the Contra Ricciala just under her knees. Screaming more in shock than in pain, Cecilia de Ricura fell backward into the water. It was all over a few seconds after that. The shark came up biting and must have taken her by one or both legs. They turned over and over in the water a few times. Locke caught glimpses of the frantic woman's form alternating with the dark, rough hide of the shark. White, then grey. White, then grey. In moments the pink foam was dark red once more, and the two struggling shadows were sinking into the depths beneath the platforms. Half the crowd roared lusty approval. The rest bowed their heads in a respectful silence that would last just until the next young woman entered the ring of red water.
Gods!
Doña Sofia stared at the spreading stain on the water. The surviving fighters stood with their heads lowered, and the priests were gesturing some sort of mutual blessing.
Unbelievable! Taken in so fast by such a simple trick! Well, my father used to say that one moment of misjudgment at the revel is worth 10 at any other time.
Locke bowed deeply to her, taking one hand and kissing it.
I doubt him not at all, Doña Sofia, not at all.
Smiling amiably, he bowed to her once more, then turned to shake hands with her husband.
Interlude. Locke stays for dinner. 1.
What?
Locke nearly jumped to his feet.
What are you talking about?
My boy, said Chains, my intermittently brilliant little boy. Your world has such small horizons. You can see clearly enough to pull a fast one on someone, but you can't see past the immediate consequences. Until you learn to think ahead of the repercussions, you are putting yourself and everyone around you in danger. You can't help being young, but it's past time that you stopped being stupid, so listen carefully. Your first mistake was that taking coin from the watch isn't a beating offence. It's a killing offence. Are we clear on that? Here in Camor, the watch takes our coin, and never the other way around. This rule is set in stone, and there are no exceptions, no matter what kind of thief you are. It's death. It's a throat-slashing, shark-feeding, off-to-meet-the-gods offence. Clear? Locke nodded. So when you set Veslin up, you really set him up. But you compounded this mistake when you used a white iron coin. You know how much a full crown is worth, exactly?
Lots.
Ah, lots isn't exactly. You don't speak Theron, or you don't really know.
I guess I don't really know.
Well, if everything's butter and nobody's been shaving the damn things, that little piece of shiny white iron was worth 40 silver solons. You see? 240 coppers. Your eyes are wide. That means you can think that big. That you understand?
Yes. Wow.
Yes. Wow. Let me put it in perspective. A yellow jacket, one of our selfless and infinitely dutiful city watchmen, might make that much for 2 months of daily duty. And watchmen are decently paid for common folk, and they sure as blessed shit do not get paid in white iron.
Eh?
So not only was Veslin taking money, he was taking too much money. A full crown. You can buy a death for much less, yours included.
How much did you pay for my...
Locke tapped his chest, where the death mark still hung beneath his shirt. I don't mean to prick your rather substantial opinion of yourself, but I'm still not sure if it was 2 coppers wisely spent. At the boy's expression, Chains barked out a rich, genuine laugh, but then his voice grew serious once again. Keep guessing, boy. But the point remains. You can get good, hard men to do serious work for less.
You could buy 5 or 6 major pieces of business, if you know what I mean. So when you stuck a white iron coin in Veslin's things,
it was too much money for anything simple?
Dead on. Far too much money for information or errands. Nobody in their right mind gives a fucking graveyard urchin a full crown. Unless that urchin is being paid to do something big. Kill your old master, for example. Smoke out all of Shades Hill and everyone in it. So if the poor thief-maker was upset to discover that Veslin was on the take, you can imagine how he felt when he saw how much money was involved. Locke nodded furiously. Ah, so. 2 mistakes. Your 3rd mistake was involving Gregor. Was Gregor supposed to get hit with the ugly stick?
I didn't like him, but no. I just wanted Veslin. Maybe I wanted Gregor to get a little, but not as much as Veslin.
Just so. You had a target, and you had a twist to play on that target, but you didn't control the situation. So your game for Veslin spilled over, and Gregor Foss got the knife too.
That's what I said, isn't it? I already admitted it.
Angry now? My, yes, you would be. Angry that you fucked up. Angry that you're not as clever as you think. Angry that the gods gave lots of other people the same sort of brain they gave Locke Lamora. Quite the pisser, isn't it?
Locke blew his little lamp out with one quick breath, then flung it in an arc, as high over the parapet as his slender arm could throw. The crash of its landing was lost in the murmur of the busy Camorri night. The boy crossed his arms defensively.
"Well, it certainly is nice to be free from the threat of that lamp, my boy."
Chains drew a last breath of smoke, then rubbed his dwindling sheaf of tobacco out against the roof stones.
"Was it informing for the Duke, plotting to murder us?"
Locke said nothing, teeth clenched and lower lip protruding. Petulance, the natural non-verbal language of the very young. Chains snorted.
"I do believe everything you've told me, Locke, because I had a long talk with your former master before I took you off his hands. Like I said, he told me everything. He told me about your last and biggest mistake, the one that tipped him off and got you sent here. Can you guess what it might have been?"
Locke shook his head.
"Can't or won't?"
"I really don't know."
Locke looked down.
"I hadn't actually thought about it."
"You showed other kids in streets the white iron coin, didn't you? You had them help you look for it. You let some of them know what it might be used for, and you ordered them not to talk about it. But what did you, back that order up with?"
Locke's eyes widened. His pout returned, but his petulance evaporated.
They hated Veslin, too. They wanted to see him get it."
"Of course. Maybe that was enough for one day. But what about later? After Veslin was dead, and Gregor was dead, and your master had had a chance to cool down some and reflect on the situation? What if he started asking questions about a certain Lamora boy? What if he took some of your little boon companions from streets and asked them nicely if Locke Lamora had been up to anything unusual, even for him?"
"Oh."
The boy winced.
"Oh. Oh, ho, ho."
Chains reached out and slapped the boy on the shoulder.
"Enlightenment! When it comes like a brick to the head, doesn't it?"
"I guess."
"So," said Chains, "now you see where everything went wrong. How many boys and girls are in that little hill, Locke? 100? 120? More? How many do you really think your old master could handle if they turned on him? 1 or 2, no problem, but 4? 8? All of them?"
"We, I guess we never thought about it."
Because he doesn't rule his graveyard by logic, boy. He rules it by fear. Fear of him keeps the older sprats in line. Fear of them keeps little shits like you in line. Anything that undermines that fear is a threat to his position. Enter Locke.